Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week, we bring you two stories by Ambrose Bierce in honor of Veterans Day, an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, and the crime at Pickett's Mill. Kurt Vonnegut Jr. considered an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge to be the greatest American short story and a work of flawless American genius. Bierce wrote his war stories from firsthand experience, having enlisted in the Army at the onset of the Civil War. Known for his satirical wit and sardonic view of human nature, Ambrose Bierce earned the nickname Bitter Bierce. In December 1913, Bierce traveled to Chihuahua, Mexico to gain firsthand experience of the Mexican Revolution. He disappeared and was rumored to be traveling with rebel troops. He was never seen again. And now, An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge by Ambrose Bierce. A man stood upon a railroad bridge in northern Alabama, looking down into the swift water 20 feet below. The man's hands were tied behind his back, the wrists bound with a cord. A rope closely encircled his neck. It was attached to a stout cross timber above his head, and the slack fell to his knees. Some loose boards laid upon the sleepers supporting the metals of the railway supplied a footing for him and his executioners. Two private soldiers of the Federal Army, directed by a sergeant who in civil life may have been a deputy sheriff. At a short remove upon the same temporary platform was an officer in the uniform of his rank, armed. He was a captain. A sentinel at each end of the bridge stood with his rifle in the position known as support. That is to say, vertical in front of the left shoulder, the hammer resting on the forearm thrown straight across the chest. A formal and unnatural position, enforcing an erect carriage of the body. It did not appear to be the duty of these two men to know what was occurring at the center of the bridge. They merely blockaded the two ends of the foot planking that traversed. Beyond one of these sentinels, nobody was in sight. The railroad ran straight away into a forest for 100 yards, then curving, was lost to view. Doubtless there was an outpost farther along. The other bank of the stream was open ground, a gentle acclivity topped with a stockade of vertical tree trunks, loopholed for rifles, with a single embrasure through which protruded the muzzle of a brass cannon commanding the bridge. Midway of the slope, between the bridge and fort, were the spectators, a single company of infantry in line, at parade rest, the butts of the rifles on the ground, the barrels inclining slightly backward against the right shoulder, the hands crossed upon the stock. A lieutenant stood at the right of the line, the point of his sword upon the ground, his left hand resting upon his right. Excepting the group of four at the center of the bridge, not a man moved. The company faced the bridge, staring stonily, motionless. The sentinels, facing the banks of the stream, might have been statues to adorn the bridge. The captain stood with folded arms, silent, observing the work of his subordinates, making no sign. Death is a dignitary, who, when he comes announced, is to be received with formal manifestations of respect, even by those most familiar with him. In the code of the military etiquette, silence and fixity are forms of deference. The man who was engaged in being hanged was apparently about 35 years of age. He was a civilian, if one might judge from his habit, which was that of a planter. His features were good, a straight nose, firm mouth, broad forehead, from which his long, dark hair was combed straight back, falling behind his ears to the collar of his well-fitted frock coat. He wore a mustache and pointed beard, but no whiskers. His eyes were large and dark gray, and had a kindly expression which one would hardly have expected in one whose neck was in the hemp. Evidently this was no vulgar assassin. The liberal military code makes provisions for hanging many kinds of persons, and gentlemen are not excluded. The preparations being completed, the two private soldiers stepped aside, and each drew away the plank upon which he had been standing. The sergeant turned to the captain, saluted, and placed himself immediately behind that officer, who in turn moved apart 1 pace. This movement left the condemned man and the sergeant standing on the two ends of the same plank, which spanned three of the cross ties of the bridge. The end upon which the civilian stood almost but not quite reached a fourth. This plank had been held in place by the weight of the captain. It was now held by that of the sergeant. At a signal from the former, the latter would step aside, the plank would tilt, and the condemned man go down between two ties. The arrangement commended itself to its judgment as simple and effective. His face had not been covered, nor his eyes bandaged. He looked a moment at his unsteadfast footing, then let his gaze wander to the swirling water of the stream racing madly beneath his feet. A piece of dancing driftwood caught his attention, and his eyes followed it down the current. How slowly it appeared to move! What a sluggish stream! He closed his eyes in order to fix his last thoughts upon his wife and children. The water, touched to gold by the early sun, the brooding mists under the banks at some distance down the stream, the fort, the soldiers, the piece of drift, all had distracted him, and now he became conscious of a new disturbance. Striking through the thought of his dear ones was a sound which he could neither ignore nor understand, a sharp, distinct, metallic percussion like the stroke of a blacksmith's hammer upon the anvil. It had the same ringing quality. He wondered what it was, and whether immeasurably distant or nearby. It seemed both. Its recurrence was regular, but as slow as the tolling of a death knell. He awaited each stroke with impatience and, he knew not why, apprehension. The intervals of silence grew progressively longer. The delays became maddening. With their greater infrequency, the sound increased in strength and sharpness. They hurt his ear like the thrust of a knife. He feared he would shriek. What he heard was the ticking of his watch. He unclosed his eyes and saw again the water below him. If I could free my hands, he thought, I might throw off the noose and spring into the stream. By diving, I could evade the bullets and, swimming vigorously, reach the bank, take the woods, and get away home. My home, thank God, is as yet outside their lines. My wife and little ones are still beyond the invaders' farthest advance. As these thoughts, which have here to be set down in words, were flashed into the doomed man's brain rather than evolved from it, the captain nodded to the sergeant. The sergeant stepped aside. Peyton Farquhar was a well-to-do planter of an old and highly respected Alabama family. Being a slave owner and, like other slave owners, a politician, he was naturally an original secessionist and ardently devoted to the Southern cause. Circumstances of an imperious nature, which it is unnecessary to relate here, had prevented him from taking service with the gallant army that had fought the disastrous campaigns, ending with the fall of Corinth, and he chafed under the inglorious restraint, longing for the release of his energies, the larger life of the soldier, the opportunity for distinction. That opportunity, he felt, would come, as it comes to all in wartime. Meanwhile, he did what he could. No service was too humble for him to perform in aid of the South, no adventure too perilous for him to undertake, if consistent with the character of a civilian who was at heart a soldier, and who in good faith and without too much qualification assented to at least a part of the frankly villainous dictum that all is fair in love and war. One evening, while Farquhar and his wife were sitting on a rustic bench near the entrance to his grounds, a gray-clad soldier rode up to the gate and asked for a drink of water. Mrs. Farquhar was only too happy to serve him with her own white hands. While she was fetching the water, her husband approached the dusty horseman and inquired eagerly for news from the front. "The Yanks are repairing the railroad," said the man, "and are getting ready for another advance. They have reached the Owl Creek Bridge, put in an order, and built a stockade on the north bank. The commandant has issued an order, which is posted everywhere, declaring that all civilian caught interfering with the railroad, its bridges, tunnels, or trains, will be summarily hanged. I saw the order." "How far is it to the Owl Creek Bridge?" Farquhar asked. "About 30 miles." "Is there no force on this side of the creek?" "Only a picket post about 1/2 mile out on the railroad, and a single sentinel at this end of the bridge." "Suppose a man, a civilian and student of hanging, should elude the picket post and perhaps get the better of the sentinel," said Farquhar, smiling. What could he accomplish? The soldier reflected. I was there a month ago, he replied. I observed that the flood of last winter had lodged a great quantity of driftwood against the wooden pier at this end of the bridge. It is now dry and would burn like tow. The lady had now brought the water, which the soldier drank. He thanked her ceremoniously, bowed to her husband, and rode away. An hour later, after nightfall, he repassed the plantation, going northward in the direction from which he had come. He was a federal scout. As Peyton Farquhar fell straight downward through the bridge, he lost consciousness and was as one already dead. From this state he was awakened, ages later it seemed to him, by the pain of a sharp pressure upon his throat, followed by a sense of suffocation. Keen, poignant agony seemed to shoot from his neck downward through every fiber of his body and limbs. These pains appeared to flash along the well-defined lines of ramification and to beat with an inconceivable rapid periodicity. They seemed like streams of pulsating fire heating him to an intolerable temperature. As to his head, he was conscious of nothing but a feeling of fullness, of congestion. These sensations were unaccompanied by thought. The intellectual part of his nature was already effaced. He had power only to feel, and feel was torment. He was conscious of motion, encompassed in a luminous cloud of which he was now merely the fiery heart. Without material substance, he swung through unthinkable arcs of oscillation, like a vast pendulum. Then, all at once, with terrible suddenness, the light about him shot upward with the noise of a loud splash. A frightful roaring was in his ear, and all was cold and dark. The power of thought was restored. He knew that the rope had broken and he had fallen into the stream. There was no additional strangulation. The noose about his neck was already suffocating him and kept the water from his lungs. To die of hanging at the bottom of a river, the idea seemed to him ludicrous. He opened his eyes in the darkness and saw above him a gleam of light. But how distant, how inaccessible. He was still sinking, for the light became fainter and fainter until it was a mere glimmer. Then it began to grow and brighten, and he knew that he was rising toward the surface, knew it with reluctance, for he was now very comfortable. To be hanged and drowned, he thought, that is not so bad. But I do not wish to be shot. No, I will not be shot. That is not fair. He was not conscious of an effort, but a sharp pain in his wrist apprised him that he was trying to free his hands. He gave the struggle his attention, as an idler might observe the feat of a juggler, without interest in the outcome. What splendid effort! What magnificent, what superhuman strength! Ah, that was a fine endeavor! Bravo! The cord fell away, his arms parted and floated upward, the hands dimly seen on each side in the growing light. He watched them with a new interest as first one and then the other pounced upon the noose at his neck. They tore it away and thrust it fiercely aside, its undulations resembling those of a water snake. Put it back! Put it back! He thought he shouted these words to his hands, for the undoing of the noose had been succeeded by the direst pang that he had yet experienced. His neck ached horribly. His brain was on fire. His heart, which had been fluttering faintly, gave a great leap, trying to force itself out at his mouth. His whole body was racked and wrenched with an unsupportable anguish, but his disobedient hands gave no heed to the command. They beat the water vigorously with quick downward strokes, forcing him to the surface. He felt his head emerge. His eyes were blinded by the sunlight. His chest expanded convulsively, and with a supreme and crowning agony, his lungs engulfed a great draft of air, which instantly he expelled in a shriek. He was now in full possession of his physical senses. They were, indeed, preternaturally keen and alert. Something in the awful disturbance of his organic system had so exalted and refined them that they made record of things never before perceived. He felt the ripples upon his face and heard their separate sounds as they struck. He looked at the forest on the bank of the stream, saw the individual trees, the leaves and the veining of each leaf, saw the very insects upon them, the locusts, the brilliant-bodied flies, the gray spiders stretching their webs from twig to twig. He noted the prismatic colors in all the dewdrops upon a million blades of grass. the humming of the gnats that danced above the eddies of the stream, the beating of the dragonfly's wings, the strokes of the water spider's legs, like oars which had lifted their boat, all these made audible music. A fish slid along beneath his eyes, and he heard the rush of its body parting the water. He had come to the surface, facing down the stream. In a moment, the visible world seemed to wheel slowly round, himself the pivotal point, and he saw the bridge, the fort, the soldiers upon the bridge, the captain, the sergeant, the two privates, his executioners. They were in silhouette against the blue sky. They shouted and gesticulated, pointing at him. The captain had drawn his pistol but did not fire. The others were unarmed. Their movements were grotesque and horrible, their forms gigantic. Suddenly he heard a sharp report, and something struck the water smartly within a few inches of his head, spattering his face with spray. He heard a second report, and saw one of the sentinels with his rifle at his shoulder, a light cloud of blue smoke rising from the muzzle. The man in the water saw the eye of the man on the bridge, gazing into his own through the sights of the rifle. He observed that it was a gray eye, and remembered having read that gray eyes were keenest, and that all famous marksmen had them. Nevertheless, this one had missed. A counter-swirl caught Farquaad and turned him half round. He was again looking into the forest on the bank opposite the fort. The sound of a clear, high voice in a monotonous sing-song now rang out behind him and came across the water with a distinctness that pierced and subdued all other sounds, even the beating of the ripples in his ears. Although no soldier, he had frequented camps enough to know the dread significance of that deliberate, drawling, aspirated chant. The lieutenant on shore was taking a part in the morning's work. How coldly and pitilessly, with what an even, calm intonation and enforcing tranquility in the men. With what accurately measured intervals fell those cruel words.
"Attention, company! Shoulder arms! Ready! Aim! Fire!"
Farquaad dived as deeply as he could. The water roared in his ears like the voice of Niagara, yet he heard the dull thud of the volley, and rising again toward the surface met shining bits of metal singularly flattened, oscillating slowly downward. Some of them touched him on the face and hands, then fell away, continuing their descent. One lodged between his collar and neck. It was uncomfortably warm, and he snatched it out. As he rose to the surface, gasping for breath, he saw that he had been a long time under water. He was perceptibly farther down the stream, nearer to safety. The soldiers had almost finished reloading. The metal ramrods flashed all at once in the sunshine as they were drawn from the barrels, turned in the air, and thrust into their sockets. The two sentinels fired again, independently and ineffectually. The hunted man saw all this over his shoulder. He was now swimming vigorously with the current. His brain was as energetic as his arms and legs. He thought with the rapidity of lightning. The officer, he reasoned, will not make that martinet's error a second time. It is as easy to dodge a volley as a single shot. He was probably already given the command to fire at will. God help me, I cannot dodge them all. An appalling splash within 2 yards of him was followed by a loud rushing sound, diminuendo, which seemed to travel back through the air to the fort and died in an explosion which stirred the very river to its deeps. A rising sheet of water curved over him, fell down upon him, blinded him, strangled him. The cannon had taken a hand in the game. As he shook his head free from the commotion of the smitten water, he heard the deflective shot humming through the air ahead, and in an instant it was cracking and smashing the branches of the forest beyond. "They will not do that again," he thought. "The next time they will use a charge of grape. I must keep my eye upon the gun. The smoke will apprise me. The report arrives too late. It lags behind the missile. That is a good gun." Suddenly he felt himself whirled round and round, spinning like a top. The water, the banks, the forest, the now distant bridge, fort, and men, all were commingling and blurred. Objects were represented by their colors only. Circular horizontal streaks of color. That was all he saw. He had been caught in a vortex and was being whirled on with a velocity of advance and gyration that made him giddy and sick. In a few moments he was flung upon the gravel at the foot of the left bank of the stream, the south bank, and behind a projected point which concealed him from his enemies. The sudden arrest of his motion, the abrasion of one of his hands on the gravel, restored him, and he wept with delight. He dug his fingers into the sand, threw it over himself in handfuls, and audibly blessed it. It looked like diamonds, rubies, emeralds. He could think of nothing beautiful which it did not resemble. The trees upon the bank were giant garden plants. He noted a definite order in their arrangement, inhaled the fragrance of their blooms. A strange rose light shone through the spaces among the trunks, and the wind made in their branches the music of Aeolian harps. He had no wish to perfect his escape, was content to remain in that enchanted spot until retaken. A whiz and rattle of grapeshot among the branches high above his head roused him from his dream. The baffled cannoneer had fired him a random farewell. He sprang to his feet, rushed up the sloping bank, and plunged into the forest. All that day he traveled, laying his course by the rounding sun. The forest seemed interminable. Nowhere did he discover a break in it, not even a woodman's road. He did not know that he lived in so wild a region. There was something uncanny in the revelation. By nightfall he was fatigued, footsore, famishing. The thought of his wife and children urged him on. At last he found a road which led him in what he knew to be the right direction. It was as wide and straight as a city street, yet it seemed untraveled. No fields bordered it, no dwelling anywhere. Not so much as the barking of a dog suggested human habitation. The black bodies of the trees formed a straight wall on both sides, terminating on the horizon in a point, like a diagram in a lesson in perspective. Overhead, as he looked up through this rift in the wood, shone great garden stars looking unfamiliar and grouped in strange constellations. He was sure they were arranged in some order which had a secret and malign significance. The wood on either side was full of singular noises, among which, once, twice, and again, he distinctly heard whispers in an unknown tongue. His neck was in pain, and lifting his hand to it, found it horribly swollen. He knew that he had a circle of black where the rope had bruised it. His eyes felt congested. He could no longer close them. His tongue was swollen with thirst. He relieved its fever by thrusting it forward from between his teeth into the cold air. How softly the turf had captured the untraveled avenue. He could no longer feel the roadway beneath his feet. Doubtless, despite his suffering, he had fallen asleep while walking, for now he sees another scene. Perhaps he has merely recovered from a delirium. He stands at the gate of his own home. All is as he left it, and all bright and beautiful in the morning sunshine. He must have traveled the entire night. As he pushes open the gate and passes up the wide white walk, he sees a flutter of female garments. His wife, looking fresh and cool and sweet, steps down from the veranda to meet him. At the bottom of the steps, she stands waiting with a smile of ineffable joy, an attitude of matchless grace and dignity. Ah, how beautiful she is! She springs forward with extended arms. As he is about to clasp her, he feels a stunning blow upon the back of his neck. A blinding white light blazes all about him with a sound like the shock of a cannon. Then all is darkness and silence. Peyton Farquhar was dead. His body, with a broken neck, swung gently from side to side beneath the timbers of the Owl Creek Bridge. And now, the crime at Pickett's Mill. There is a class of events which by their very nature, and despite any intrinsic interest that they may possess, are foredoomed to oblivion. They are merged in the general story of those greater events by which they were a part, as the thunder of a billow breaking on a distant beach is unnoted in the continuous roar. To how many having knowledge of the battles of our Civil War does the name Pickett's Mill suggest acts of heroism and devotion performed in scenes of awful carnage to accomplish the impossible? Buried in the official reports of the victors, there are indeed imperfect accounts of the engagement. the vanquished have not thought it expedient to relate it. It is ignored by General Sherman in his memoirs, yet Sherman ordered it. General Howard wrote an account of the campaign of which it was an incident, and dismissed it in a single sentence. And yet General Howard planned it, and it was fought as an isolated and independent action under his eye. Whether it is so trifling an affair as to justify this inattention, let the reader judge. The fight occurred on the 27th of May, 1864, while the armies of Generals Sherman and Johnston confronted each other near Dallas, Georgia, during the memorable Atlanta campaign. For 3 weeks we had been pushing the Confederates southward, partly by maneuvering, partly by fighting, out of Delta, out of Resaca, through Adairsville, Kingston, and Cassville. Each army offered battle everywhere, but would accept it only on its own terms. At Dallas, Johnston made another stand, and Sherman, facing the hostile line, began his customary maneuverings for an advantage. General Wood's division of Howard's corps occupied a position opposite the Confederate right. Johnston, finding himself on the 26th, overlapped by Schofield, still farther to Wood's left, retired his right, Polk, across a creek, whither we followed him into the woods with a deal of desultory bickering, and at nightfall had established the new lines at nearly a right angle with the old, Schofield reaching well around and threatening the Confederate rear. The civilian reader must not suppose when he reads accounts of military operations, in which relative position of the forces are defined, as in the foregoing passages, that these were matters of general knowledge to those engaged. Such statements are commonly made, even by those high in command, in the light of later disclosures, such as the enemy's official reports. It is seldom, indeed, that a subordinate officer knows anything about the disposition of the enemy's forces, except that it is unamiable, or precisely whom he is fighting. As to the rank and file, they can know nothing more of the matter than the arms they carry. They hardly know what troops are upon their own right or left, the length of a regiment away. If it is a cloudy day, they are ignorant even of the points of the compass. It may be said generally that a soldier's knowledge of what is going on about him is coterminous with his official relation to it and his personal connection with it. What is going on in front of him, he does not know at all until he learns it afterward. At 9 o'clock on the morning of the 27th, Wood's division was withdrawn and replaced by Stanley's. Supported by Johnston's division, it moved at 10 o'clock to the left, in the rear of Schofield, a distance of 4 miles through a forest, and at 2 o'clock in the afternoon had reached a position where General Howard believed himself free to move in behind the enemy's forces and attack them in the rear, or at least striking them in the flank, crush his way along their line in the direction of its length, then throw them into confusion and prepare an easy victory for a supporting attack in front. In selecting General Howard for this bold adventure, General Sherman was doubtless not mindful of Chancellorsville, where Stonewall Jackson had executed a similar maneuver for Howard's instruction. Experience is a normal school. It teaches how to teach. There are some differences to be noted. At Chancellorsville, it was Jackson who attacked. At Pickett's Mill, Howard. At Chancellorsville, it was Howard who was assailed. At Pickett's Mill, Hood. The significance of the first distinction is doubled by that of the second. The attack, it was understood, was to be made in column of brigades, Hazen's brigade of Wood's division leading. That, such was at least Hazen's understanding, I learned from his own lips during the movement, as I was an officer of his staff. But after a march of less than a mile, an hour, and a further delay of 3 hours at the end of it, to acquaint the enemy of our intention to surprise him, our single shrunken brigade of 1,500 men was sent forward, without support, to double up the army of General Jackson's. "We will put in Hazen and see what success he has." In the words of General Wood to General Howard, we were first apprised of the true nature of the distinction about to be conferred upon us. General W.B. Hazen is a born fighter, an educated soldier, after the war chief signal officer of the army, and now long dead, was the best hated man I ever knew. And his very memory is a terror to every unworthy soul in the service. His was a stormy life. He was in trouble all around. Grant, Sherman, Sheridan, and a countless multitude of the less eminent luckless had the misfortune at one time and another to incur his disfavor, and he tried to punish them all. He was always, after the war, the central figure of a court-martial or a congressional inquiry, was accused of everything, from stealing to cowardice, was banished to obscure posts, jumped on by the press, traduced in public and in private, and always emerged triumphant. While signal officer, he went up against the Secretary of War and put him to controversial sword. He convicted Sheridan of falsehood, Sherman of barbarism, Grant of inefficiency. He was aggressive, arrogant, tyrannical, honorable, truthful, courageous, a skillful soldier, a faithful friend, and one of the most exasperating of men. Duty was his religion, and like the Muslim, he proselyted with the sword. His missionary efforts were directed chiefly against the spiritual darkness of his superiors in rank, though he would turn aside from pursuit of his erring command to set a chicken-thieving orderly astride a wooden horse, with a heavy stone attached to each foot. Hazen, said a brother brigadier, is a synonym of insubordination. For my commander and my friend, my master in the art of war, now unable to answer for himself, let this fact answer. When he heard Wood say that they would put him in and see what success he would have in defeating an army, when he saw Howard assent, he uttered never a word, rode to the head of his feeble brigade, and patiently awaited the command to go. Only by a look, which I knew how to read, did he betray his sense of the criminal blunder. The enemy now had 7 hours in which to learn of the movement and prepare to meet it. General Johnston says, "The Federal troops extended their entrenched line, we did not entrench, so rapidly to their left that it was found necessary to transfer Claiborne's division to Hardee's corps to our right, where it was formed on the prolongation of Polk's line." General Hood, commanding the enemy's right corps, says, "On the morning of the 27th, the enemy were known to be rapidly extending their left, attempting to turn my right as they extended. Claiborne was deployed to meet them, and at 5:30 p.m. a very stubborn attack was made on this division, extending to the right, where Major General Wheeler with his cavalry division was engaging them. The assault was continued with great determination upon both Claiborne and Wheeler." That, then, was the situation. A weak brigade of 1,500 men, with masses of idle troops behind, in the character of audience, waiting for the word to march a quarter mile uphill through almost impassable tangles of underwood, along and across precipitous ravines, and attack beastworks constructed at leisure, and manned with 2 divisions of troops as good as themselves. True, we did not know all this, but if any man on the ground besides Wood and Howard expected a walkover, he must have been a singularly hopeful disposition. As a topographical engineer, it had been my duty to make a hasty examination of the ground in front. In doing so, I pushed far enough forward through the forest to hear distinctly the murmur of the enemy awaiting us, and this had been duly reported. But from our lines nothing could be heard but the wind among the trees and the songs of birds. Someone said it was a pity to frighten them, but there would necessarily be more or less noise. We laughed at that. Men awaiting death on the battlefield laugh easily, though not infectiously. The brigade was formed in 4 battalions, 2 in front and 2 in rear. This gave us a front of about 200 yards. The right front battalion was commanded by Colonel R. L. Kimberly of the 41st Ohio, the left by Colonel O. H. Payne of the 124th Ohio, the rear battalions by Colonel J. C. Foy, 23rd Kentucky, and Colonel W. W. Berry, 5th Kentucky, all brave and skillful officers tested by experience on many fields. The whole command, known as the 2nd Brigade, 3rd Division, 4th Corps, consisted of no fewer than 9 regiments, reduced by long service to an average of less than 200 men each. With full ranks and only the necessary details for special duty, we should have had some 8,000 rifles in line. We moved forward. In less than 1 minute, the trim battalions had become simply a swarm of men struggling through the undergrowth of the forest, pushing and crowding. The front was irregularly serrated, the longest and bravest in advance, the others following in fan-like formations, variable and inconstant, ever defining themselves anew. For the first 200 yards, our course lay along the left bank of a small creek in a deep ravine, our left battalion sweeping along its steep slope. Then we came to the fork of the ravine. A part of us crossed below, the rest above, passing over both branches. The regiment inextricably intermingled, rendering all military formation impossible. The color bearers kept well to the front with their flags closely furled, aslant backward over their shoulders. Displayed, they would have been torn to rags by the boughs of the trees. Horses were also sent to the rear. The general and the staff and all the field officers toiled along on foot as best they could. "We shall halt and form when I get out of this," said an aide-de-camp. Suddenly there came a ringing rattle of musketry, the familiar hissing of bullets, and before us the interspaces of the forest were all blue with smoke. Hoarse, fierce yells broke out of a thousand throats. The forward fringe of the brave and hardy assailants was arrested in its mutable extensions. The edge of our swarm grew dense and clearly defined as the foremost halted, and the rest pressed forward to align themselves beside them, all firing. The uproar was deafening. The air was sibilant with streams and sheets of missiles. In the steady, unvarying roar of small arms, the frequent shock of the cannon was rather felt than heard, but the gusts of grape, which they blew into that populous wood, were audible enough, screaming among the trees and cracking their stems and branches. We had, of course, no artillery to reply. Our brave color-bearers were now all in the forefront of the battle in the open, for the enemy had cleared a space in front of his breastworks. They held the colors erect, shook out their glories, waved them forward and back to keep them spread, for there was no wind. From where I stood at the right of the line, we had halted and formed indeed. I could see 6 of our flags at one time. Occasionally one would go down, only to be instantly lifted by other hands. I must here quote again from General Johnston's account of this engagement, for nothing could more truly indicate the resolute nature of the attack than the Confederate belief that it was made by the whole Fourth Corps instead of one weak brigade. The Fourth Corps came on in deep order and assailed the Texans with great vigor, receiving their close and accurate fire with the fortitude always exhibited by General Sherman's troops in the actions of this campaign. The Federal troops approached within a few yards of the Confederates, but at last were forced to give way by their storm of well-directed bullets, and fell back to the shelter of a hollow near and behind them. They left hundreds of corpses within 20 paces of the Confederate line. When the United States troops paused in their advance within 15 paces of the Texas front, one of their color-bearers planted his colors 8 or 10 feet in front of his regiment and was instantly shot dead. A soldier sprang forward to his place and fell also as he grasped the color staff. A second and third followed successively, and each received death as speedily as his predecessors. A fourth, however, seized and bore back the object of soldierly devotion. Such incidents have occurred in battle from time to time since men began to venerate the symbols of their cause, but they are not commonly related by the enemy. If General Johnston had known that his veteran divisions were throwing their successive lines against fewer than 1,500 men, his glowing attribute to his enemy's valor could hardly have been more generously expressed. I can attest the truth of this soldierly praise. I saw the occurrence that he relates, and regret that I am unable to recall even the name of the regiment whose colors were so gallantly saved. Early in my military experience, I used to ask myself how it was that brave troops could retreat while still their courage was high. As long as a man is not disabled, he can go forward. Can it be anything but fear that makes him stop and finally retire? Are there signs by which he can infallibly know the struggle to be hopeless? In this engagement, as in others, my doubts were answered as to the fact. The explanation is still obscure. In many instances which have come under my observation, when hostile lines of infantry engage at close range and the assailants afterward retire, there was a dead line beyond which no man advanced but to fall. Not a soul of them ever reached the enemy's front to be bayoneted or captured. It was a matter of the difference of 3 or 4 paces, too small a distance to affect the accuracy of aim. In these affairs, no aim is taken at individual antagonists. The soldier delivers his fire at the thickest mass in his front. The fire is, of course, as deadly at 20 paces as at 15, at 15 as at 10. Nevertheless, there is a dead line with its well-defined edge of corpses, those of the bravest, where both lines are fighting without cover, as in a charge met by a countercharge. Each has its dead line, and between the two is a clear space, neutral ground, devoid of dead, for the living cannot reach it to fall there. I observed this phenomenon at Pickett's Mill. Standing at the right of the line, I had an unobstructed view of the narrow, open space across which the two lines fought. It was dim with smoke, but not greatly obscured. The smoke rose and spread in sheets among the branches of the trees. Most of our men fought kneeling as they fired, many of them behind trees, stones, and whatever cover they could get. But there were considerable groups that stood. Occasionally, one of these groups, which had endured the storm of missiles for moments without perceptible reduction, would push forward, moved by a common despair, and wholly detach itself from the line. In a second, every man of the group would be down. There had been no visible movement of the enemy, no audible change in the awful, even roar of the firing, yet all were down. Frequently, the dim figure of an individual soldier would be seen to spring away from his comrades, advancing alone toward that fateful interspace with leveled bayonet. He got no farther than the further of his predecessors. Of the hundreds of corpses within 20 paces of the Confederate line, I venture to say that a third were within 15 paces, and not one within 10. It is the perception, perhaps unconscious, of this inexplicable phenomenon that causes the still unarmed, still vigorous, and still courageous soldier to retire without having come into actual contact with his foe. He sees or feels that he cannot. His bayonet is a useless weapon for slaughter. Its purpose is a moral one, its mandate exhausted. He sheathes it and trusts to the bullet. That failing, he retreats. He has done all that he could with such appliances as he has. No command to fall back was given. None could have been heard. Man by man, the survivors withdrew at will, sifting through the trees into the cover of the ravines, among the wounded, who could draw themselves back, among the sulkers, whom nothing could have dragged forward. The left of our short line had fought at the corner of a cornfield, the field along the right side of which was parallel to the direction of our retreat. As the disorganized groups fell back along this fence on the wooded side, they were attacked by a flanking force of the enemy moving through the field in a direction nearly parallel with what had been our front. This force, I infer from General Johnston's account, consists of the brigade of General Lowry, or two Arkansas regiments under Colonel Baucom. I had been sent by General Hazen to that point and arrived in time to witness this formidable movement. But already our retreating men, in obedience to their officers, their courage and their instinct of self-preservation, had formed along the fence and opened fire. The apparently slight advantage of the imperfect cover and the open range worked its customary miracle. The assault, a singularly spiritless one, considering the advantages it promised and that it was made by an organized and victorious force against a broken and retreating one, was checked. The assailants actually retired, and if they afterward renewed the movement, they encountered none but our dead and wounded. The battle, as a battle, was at an end, but there was still some slaughtering that it was possible to incur before nightfall, and as the wreck of our brigade drifted back through the forest, we met the brigade, Gibson's, which, had the attack been made in column, as it should have been, would have been but 5 minutes behind our heels, with another 5 minutes behind its own. As it was, just 45 minutes had elapsed, during which the enemy had destroyed us and was now ready to perform the same kindly office for our successors. Neither Gibson nor the brigade, which was sent to his relief, as tardily as he to our accomplished, or could have hoped to accomplish, anything whatever. I did not note their movements, having other duties, but Hazen, in his narrative of military service, says, I witnessed the attack of the two brigades following my own, and none of these troops advanced nearer than 100 yards of the enemy's work. They went in at a run, and as organizations were broken in less than a minute. Nevertheless, their losses were considerable, including several 100 prisoners taken from a sheltered place, whence they did not care to rise and run. The entire loss was about 1,400 men, of whom nearly one half fell killed and wounded in Hazen's brigade in less than 30 minutes of actual fighting. General Johnston says, "The Federal dead lying near our line were counted by many persons, officers and soldiers. According to these counts, there were 700 of them." This obviously erroneous, though I have not the means at hand to ascertain the truer number. I remember that we were all astonished at the uncommonly large proportion of dead to wounded, a consequence of the uncommonly close range at which most of the fighting was done. The action took its name from a water power mill nearby. This was on a branch of a stream having, I am sorry to say, the prosaic name of Pumpkin Vine Creek. I have my own reasons for suggesting that the name of that watercourse be altered to Sunday School Run. And those are our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed An Occurrence at Owl Creek and The Crime at Pickett's Mill by Ambrose Pierce. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.